Welcome to the final part of our series, ANCSA at 50, The Journey Continues. I'm Rhonda McBride. Saturday, December 18th, marks the 50th anniversary of a historic Alaska Federation of Natives convention when delegates gathered in Anchorage for a formal vote on the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, which President Richard Nixon had just signed. After AFN endorsed the signing, they huddled around a loudspeaker to take a phone call.
Ladies and gentlemen of the AFN, this is the White House in Washington calling. I present the President of the United States.
I appreciate this opportunity to extend my greetings and best wishes to the Convention of the Alaska Federation of Natives. I want you to be among the first to know that I have just signed the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. This is a milestone in Alaska's history and in the way our government deals with Native and Indian peoples. It shows that institutions of government are responsive.
Dr. Rosita Worrell was in the room and bore witness to this historical milestone that affected all Alaskans and continues to do so today. It gave Alaska Natives title to 44 million acres of land and almost $1 billion in compensation for the loss of their historic lands. Rosita Worrell brought two sets of eyes to this event, those of an Alaska Native who was all too familiar with how the encroachment of newcomers and Western civilization had marginalized Alaska Natives. But she also saw the Claims Act and its impact through the eyes of a trained cultural anthropologist. In a conversation we had this week, we talked about her personal connection to this story.
First of all, if I could introduce myself according to our protocols. My Tlingit names are Yedektazak and Kahani. I am an eagle of the Thunderbird clan and the house lowered from the sun in Klukwan. I'm a Chilkat, and I'm very proud to be a grandchild of the Sukakadi, the Sakai clan. And currently I serve as president of the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute. You know, it's been a wonderful time just visiting and hearing a lot about ANCSA. There's been so many sessions about ANCSA, our 50th anniversary of the enactment of ANCSA. Of course, it brought me back to when people were working on ANCSA. And at the time, I was a student at the Alaska Methodist University.
Which is now Alaska Pacific University.
Yes, Alaska Pacific. I went back to school. I went back to school with three children. So I was not, you know, your younger student. And it started off with, after my mother had passed, I got her Kugaina, that's the ANS banner. And it really made me think about the contributions my mother had made. She was a salmon cannery union organizer. And I went with her, even though I was only, you know, in sixth grade, I went with her to record minutes. But it really, you know, gave to me, I think, a grounding in our communities, a grounding in our culture, a grounding in what our people were going through at the time. And so when she passed, it really made me think. She gave me such a wonderful gift. And I wondered what I would be giving to my children. And at the same time, I was given a job as heading the Alaska Native Brotherhood Talent Search, which was a program that was recruiting students back to school. And I always tell people, the program was so good that I recruited myself to go back to school. And it was an exciting period for me. And much of that excitement related to the land claims. And I served as an intern in the AFN offices. There were people like Don Wright was there. And anyway, I was at AMU. And it was the day when President Nixon had signed the AFN bill. And AFN delegates were voting region by region. And I could tell you the excitement, you know, just the whole aura was very exciting and nerve-wracking.
So you were actually in the room. Do you remember where you were?
I was in the room, but I was not a delegate.
But where were you standing in the room?
I was in the back. I was in the back where I could be kind of an observer of what was happening. And I knew it was a historic moment. And I said there was this excitement, but a nervous excitement. And so I remember hearing the regions vote, you know, region by region, Atna, yes, you know, and on down the line. And then Arctic Slope, no.
So, Rosita, let me stop you there for just a second, because that historic vote was recorded, and I have some of the audio from that to play. And this is of the delegates voting on whether or not to approve President Nixon's signing of ANCSA. So let's listen.
Cook Inlet Native Association.
Yes.
Cook Inlet Native Association votes yes. Aleut League.
Aleut League, yes.
Aleut League votes yes. Arctic Slope.
No.
Arctic Slope votes no.
Wow, the only no vote, but what a deep gut belly no that was.
Yes, it was. Yes, yeah. And resounding through the whole convention room.
A lot of people have wondered if that came from Joe Upikson, who was head of the delegation for the North Slope, or was it from Etook, Charlie Edwardson, who was one of the more radical figures at that convention?
I thought it was Etook. It could have been Joe. I mean, Joe was actually the major spokesperson, but Etook was always there. He was like the conscience of not only North Slope people, but also Alaska Native people. He was always there. I was very fortunate to get to know Etook when I went back to school. He came back and stayed with us, actually, and he created such a chaos in Boston. You know, people loved having him around because he was such a character.
Well, if Etook didn't make that gut belly sound, he probably felt it.
It was a small convention room. You know, it's not like anything where we have our AFN conventions today. But yeah. But anyway, I was a student there. And I had this feeling that I really wanted to be involved in implementation of ANCSA. But I was going off to graduate school. And I also knew that it would be really important to have the benefits of higher education. And I was going into anthropology. A lot of people thought I would have gone into law, but I always say law is very structured and we could work to change laws. But in the formative years of ANCSA, I thought it would be really good to not have a model, a strict model, but to go by what we have as Native people, as our culture. So anyway, I went off to school. And after going to school, I did 10 years of research in the Arctic. I studied the political development of the North Slope Inupiat. I noticed that all of the political leaders were all whaling captains.
Wow, that's an interesting observation about the whaling captains.
You know, I was studying the North Slope political development. So I spent a lot of time in the North Slope Borough Assembly meetings. And at the time, you won't believe it, but I also spent time in the Arctic Slope meetings. I don't think they would let me in their board meetings today, but at the time, they let me be present. But it occurred to me as I looked around at the leadership that they were all whaling captains. And so I thought I needed to understand whaling captains. So I followed those political leaders out onto the ice. And I think this is one of the beauties of anthropology is that I said, well, these are the political leaders here in Barrow, but how about the other political leaders? So I ended up studying leaders all the way from St. Lawrence Island. I went to every whaling community and studied political leadership. But then at the time, what happened was the International Whaling Commission imposed a moratorium. And I somehow got involved in that because I think I was probably at the time the latest anthropologist who had studied whaling. And so I was called in, you know, with the State Department, and I got to interact more with the whalers, whaling captains, and the political leaders. And it was sitting not only in the North Slope Borough Assembly meetings, but also sitting in the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation meetings. And then sometimes seeing the conflicts, you know, that individuals had between development and protection of the environment. And clearly at that point in time, they were dealing with offshore oil development. And the leaders kept saying, you can't eat oil. You can't eat oil. And so they have to protect the environment, to protect the whales, because whaling was the basis of their culture. So I was getting a good grounding in not only culture, but also policies, which the leaders were using to try to protect their culture, even though at the same time they were involved in making these decisions, millions and millions of dollars of decisions. I like to tell the story about the North Slope Assembly meeting, where they had, I don't know, several million or maybe a couple $100 million decision to make. And then they heard the cry, whales, whales. And all of those assembly members, all of the whaling captains ran out of that room. And I remember the consultants said, but you've got to make these decisions. You've got to make these decisions.
Because you studied leadership from different regions, and of course the leadership is based on the subsistence activities, yes, did you notice differences from region to region in leadership styles?
Not so much the leadership, insofar as decision-making processes. And I will tell you that among the Inupiat Yupik cultures, time is not of the essence. And so they have all the time in which to make decisions. And to them, having consensus was so important. And that's a very stark difference from other regions like Southeast Alaska, you know, where they are governed by Robert rules of order. And as soon as they know they've got the majority, they'll call question, question. And so they don't have consensus. So what happens, this is at least from my observations, and I know my tribal brothers and sisters probably won't be happy with me, but they'll have to agree that after we've made those decisions here in Southeast, there's still a lot of conflicts, people with different positions, because they haven't established that consensus. Whereas among the Inupiat and Yupik, that at least the communities that I've observed, there is that consensus afterwards. And I attribute it to their culture. They are generally conflict avoidance, but they will visit one another. And I would follow assembly members house to house where they would be visiting. And then oftentimes the political issue would come up and they would talk about the political issue. And over the course of their nice conversation, they would come to agreement. And so when they would come into the formal meetings, I think a lot of the basis for that final decision had already been made.
So fascinating about how, as corporations formed, they were impacted by each region's traditions. Yes. And I guess probably that's why there's no Native corporation that's truly a carbon copy of another.
Yes, right. I always tell people, if you want to see cultural differences, go to AFN. Go to an AFN board of directors meetings where you have 36 individuals from all of the regions. You have your regional corporation, your village corporation, and then you also have your nonprofit or the regional tribe. So yeah, cultural differences definitely exist, but yet there are common themes that do unite us.
Dr. Rosita Worrell, president of the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute. When we come back, more about how competing objectives were baked into the Claims Act and how it took a while for Alaska Natives to figure out some workarounds. Welcome back to our program, ANCSA at 50, The Journey Continues. I'm Rhonda McBride. When the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act was passed, it was game on. And for Alaska Natives, it was a good thing that this was to be a long game played out over many years, something that Rosita World talked about. Here's more of my conversation with the president of the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute.
So in the 1980s, we began to realize there are some flaws with ANCSA. And you have to go back to the origins of ANCSA. When Congress was working on ANCSA, their goal and objective was to assimilate Native people. There is no doubt that their goal was to assimilate Native people. And they thought that they had the keys to it with corporations, land that was held in fee simple title, not trust lands, and then also individualism, individual shareholders. So with that, they thought that they were going to have a move towards assimilation. But Native people, their ideas were completely different. They were thinking about land.
So there was tension right from the get-go on this.
Yes. Land was the most important thing. And they wanted to have full control and ownership of their land. They rejected trust lands. And they had learned from the experiences of our brothers and sisters in the lower 48, the tribes, where they saw that the Bureau of Indian Affairs controlled their land. And they made all of the decisions around their land. We saw where Indian resources, like oil and gas and minerals, the decisions that were made for them were not in their best interest, but rather favored the developers. So our people wanted absolute control and ownership of their land. So they had competing objectives between Congress and Native people, but they used the same vehicles, each to achieve their objective, assimilation versus control and ownership of their land and economic self-determination. That's what they wanted. And they coalesced in corporations. So in the 1980s, Native people began to realize there were flaws with ANCSA. And the most important one was, and this is where in 1991, the restrictions on the sale of stock would be lifted. And there was concern if the restrictions on the sale of stock were lifted, that land or the stock would begin to transfer out of Native ownership into non-Native ownership. And we had the benefit of the fishing permit experience, where we saw that Native communities had these permits, but we gradually saw this movement of permits, the sale of permits going from Native communities to non-Native communities. So Native people were aware that this could possibly happen with land.
Boy, that's interesting. I hadn't heard that before, that the experience with the fishing permits made Native people worry that this could also happen to the land. Interesting.
Yes. So I think it was in 1982, the AFN convention said that dealing with the 1991 legislation, as they began to call it, 1991 legislation, was their highest priority. And the remarkable thing was that the Native community came together several times. They had 7 leadership retreats, and then they had 5 conventions in which they were talking about resolutions to the problems that they saw. And they came up with several themes that were so important to them. And one was land, relationship to land. They had the same relationship to land as they had to families, relationship to land like kinship, but also sacredness, this interdependence with land. And then the other one was communal orientation. They realized that we are members of a group. And this led them to the thought about their children, because in our cultures, children have ownership to the land because they are members of that group, not because they inherited a stock, a piece of paper, but because they were members of that group, they had a right to the land. And so that was one of the themes they came up with. And remarkable, the other thing they came up was Native identity. And those participants to all of those retreats and to those conventions, five conventions, and they said that identity is related to enrollment in Native corporations because Native corporations hold title to the land. They had this foresight, this vision to see that they needed to change ANCSA. And so the amendments came out for land protections. They wanted to protect the corporations and land from bankruptcy laws. They created land banks so that they didn't have to develop their land, so that they wouldn't be subject to taxation. They did those protections. They also wanted to enroll children. And there was a big argument. And I was advocating for perpetual enrollment because I thought it should replicate a tribe where you have perpetual enrollment of children because they are members of a group or a clan. And that's what I want. I was pushing for that in the amendments. But there were some regions that didn't want it. And Secretary Hodel was absolutely opposed to it because in his mind, he was still thinking about ANCSA as a vehicle to assimilate Native people. And so the government opposed our amendments to enroll children, have this automatic enrollment. So we ended up with a compromise. And this is something that I've had to learn, you know, as a young person, it should be this way, but there are compromises. And I've learned from older leaders that there is another day. There's another day in which you can deal with it, but let's move ahead. And we moved ahead and we got the provision in there to enroll children who are born after 1971, if by resolution, the corporation would approve of it. So we at least got it in there. And then the other one, the other value that Native people had was how we feel towards elders, how it was important for us to take care of our elders. So they wanted to be able to give special benefits to elders, but under a normal corporation, a regular for-profit corporation, you have to have equal distribution among all shareholders. So again, we changed ANCSA and we said, we want to give special benefits to our elders. And I called these amendments the re-tribalization of ANCSA, where we integrated our Native values into the corporation per se. So I thought that was a great success story for that phase.
So that is kind of the turning point, the 1991 amendments.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So you think of the 1991 amendments then as sort of a retribalization of ANCSA.
Yes, I do. The initial thoughts were land ownership and control of land. And that was the primary objective. But you also know that our people in those conventions and in those leadership retreats also saw the importance of land in terms of survival of culture, insofar as ensuring that future generations would have access to the land. So I think in my mind, it was a turning point. I think we beat Congress.
It sounds like a long game, and you have to play it like a long game.
This is one thing as being a younger person at the time, you know, you want it to happen right away. But I will tell you, having been engaged and serving on the Alaska board for 30 years, you know, I've learned that it doesn't always happen like that. And yet, what I love about young people is that they remind us that there are these important things. And I know Native leadership, insofar as ANCSA, they were beset with so many things that they had to do.
Before we move on, I want to talk a little bit about blood quantum because I know you've done some research in that area. But basically, in order to own stock in a Native corporation, you have to have a certain blood quantum. Can you explain how that works?
Well, first of all, the blood quantum criteria was established by the federal government. And it was a way to determine eligibility for Native programming that the government provided. And they established it at the 1/4 Native blood quantum. And they actually had criteria. The more Native blood you had, the less competent you were. And so they had to have control over your, like, say, if you had an allotment. And the less native blood you had, you were viewed as competent. So they didn't have to exert that much control over those with the native blood quantum. I think it was with the initial Indian Land Allotment Act that they established the first blood quantum. And it is a criteria to identify those individuals who would qualify for a certain federal programming. That's what it was. And so the government adopted that in ANCSA. And at the time, we didn't think about it. As I mentioned, our native leaders didn't understand, didn't see the flaws that were inherent in ANCSA. So you had to have be 1/4 Native blood to enroll into Native corporations. And then through multiple variables, we began to see a decrease in the blood quantum. First of all, you have to remember the government's whole program was to assimilate Native people. And so they would take communities of Native people, send them out to Chicago, San Francisco for training. And so they were pulling Native people away from their villages. They pulled them away for Native schools. They put them in boarding schools. And then also there was more Native people in urban communities. And I actually did a study of the out-migration of Native people from the villages, and it was primarily women, Native women who were moving out from the village, and they were marrying non-Native people. So there's a variety of factors that contribute to a diminishing number of Native people with higher blood quantums, an increasing number of Native people with less than the 1/4 blood quantum. We recently did a study of the Marine Mammal Protection Act. And in that, we studied the enrollment of Native people to get their BIA card, their Certificate of Indian Blood Determination. And from that, we could see that, and we were able to look at different studies like in Sea Alaska, where we give scholarships and we look at blood quantum, even though it's not a determining eligibility. You have to be descendant of an original shareholder. So anyway, we did these comparison studies that we had accumulated over the years. And also we did some demographic studies when we were going to have that resolution to allow for the enrollment of new shareholders who were born after 1971. So we did some demographics and looked at blood quantum there. But overall, I will say overall, there is an increase, as dramatic increase in the number of Native people who have less than the 1/4 Native blood quantum. And you could see the stark effects of it, particularly with the Marine Mammal Protection Act. And I attended the IPCOM meeting, which is an organization of marine mammal organizations. And I heard a grandfather say, "We cannot even take our grandsons out hunting seals with us. What's going to happen to our society if we're not training our children about our culture, if our grandchildren can no longer feed their grandparents by going out hunting and getting that seal or other marine mammals?" So it is having an impact on our societies. And I say this is one of the looming questions that we as Native people are going to have to deal with.
So how do you deal with that as people intermarry and the blood quantum becomes diluted, but yet people still have that Native identity? What's your suggestion for remedying this problem?
Well, of course, some might say marry Native people, but knowing humans in our society, I think we have to follow the lead of Calista and Arctic Slope and open up our enrollment to lineal descendants. And then we have to make sure that we are training our lineal descendants, instilling in them our core cultural values about our relationship to the environment, about our group orientation, about our values in caring for our community and caring for elders. I mean, there are some communities and some that adopt white people who have become assimilated into Native culture. Culture has nothing to do with blood quantum. So And in my mind, we have to move towards enrolling lineal descendants.
Dr. Rosita Worrell, president of the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute. When we come back, our conversation about the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act continues. And we explore the question, was ANCSA an experiment in capitalism, socialism, or both? You are listening to the final installment of our series marking the 50th anniversary of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. I'm Rhonda McBride. We have had many conversations since this series began about how the Claims Act was a hybrid of Western and Native approaches to land that were essentially at odds. But Congress and Alaska Natives did agree on one thing. They wanted something different from the lower 48 reservation system, which was achieved. Congress launched what it thought was an experiment in capitalism, but it may have been one in socialism as well. And in 50 years, what has been the offspring of this unlikely marriage of values? Well, during this program, I've been talking about that with Rosita Worrell, who is not only head of the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute, but also a cultural anthropologist. And over the years, she has seen what she describes as the tribalization of ANCSA. So going back to December 1971, the day that delegates to the Alaska Federation of Natives voted to approve Nixon's signing of ANCSA, do you remember, after having stood there and watched the vote, what kind of emotions you were experiencing?
I will tell you, it was joyous, in my opinion. Maybe we didn't achieve everything we wanted, like subsistence. But yet, and I have to say, I was so proud of those Native leaders who were involved. And Southeast especially owes a tribute to Emil Nadi, because Southeast was different. We owe a special tribute to Emil Nadi, because Emil Nadi cast the vote, the deciding vote, that allowed for Sea Alaska to participate in ANCSA. And that's because we had a judicial settlement. There was a taking of our land. Congress took our land for the creation of the Tongass National Forest. Congress took our land to create the Glacial Bay Park. Congress took our land for the creation of the Metlakatla Reserve. And so we in Southeast had to initiate action to secure the payment for the taking of our land, for not extinguishing Aboriginal title. So we were different. And so we came into ANCSA game with most of our land claims already, I hate to say settled, because it was taken. And so the other regions were aware that our land base that we were throwing into the ANCSA pot was much smaller.
I think a lot of people aren't really aware of this chapter of history, that Southeast Natives went to the Court of Claims. And really, that is set up to deal with cash, not land.
Right, exactly.
As, so Southeast Natives did not get satisfaction from that.
No. I mean, we were precluded from selecting land because it had been taken to create these national conservation areas. There's a book been written about conservation refugees. We in Southeast Alaska, who had been a wealthy society, we became paupers in our own land because we couldn't hunt and fish on these federally constructed land areas that were taken away from us. We're really excited here in Southeast because William Paul Sr. was a lawyer at the time, who I recognized as the father of land claims. And I was only 14 and I was working for him. And a lot of the cases he had were subsistence cases. He was the earliest one who began the fight to reclaim or to have the settlement of our Aboriginal lands. And he himself credits a Simpson, Peter Simpson. When Peter Simpson asks William Paul, whose land is it? And William says, it's our land. And Peter Simpson says, then fight for it. And so William Paul in 1929, the ANB adopts land claims as its highest priority. He is leading this. And I also like to recount that he wrote to Etook in the 1960s and told Etook that they should be filing claim to their land in the Arctic Slope. And Etook writes to him in the late 60s late 60s. And he says, I'm replying to your letter of 1960 or something like that.
Okay, let me jump in here. Etook is Charlie Edwardson, another famous fighter for the land claims.
So he was working on multiple levels for land claims, and he was actually involved in the AFN convention.
So I want to go back to a part of the story you were telling earlier about how Emil Nadi intervened when other members of the Alaska Federation of Natives objected to Southeast being part of land claims because they had filed a lawsuit and gotten some kind of a settlement, though not satisfactory. So how was it that Emil Nadi sort of changed the direction of things?
There was a tie. There was a tie vote among the AFN board of directors. And Emil Nadi, as the chair of the AFN board, broke that tie by casting the vote to allow Sea Alaska or the Southeast region to participate in the ANCSA land claims battle.
Now, to me, that seems very wise because, as you pointed out, that William Paul was kind of the father of the land claims movement. So you already have a lot of that expertise.
Yes.
And you also have very eloquent leaders like John Borbridge.
Oh, John Borbridge was amazing. He was the senior diplomat where Etook could be hollering and screaming about the injustice. John Borbridge was quiet in a very diplomatic way, advancing the arguments in a very rational fashion. Not to say that Etook wasn't rational. He was definitely rational. He was brilliant.
And he was passionate.
He was brilliant, passionate, and he saw the world. This is the way I loved Etook's mind, you know, that he would see things from, you know, the whole expansive universe of things. I mean, and he would be arguing, and then at the last sentence, he would pull it all together. He was just absolutely brilliant in that way. And he became our consciousness in a way, you know.
Well, it seems like it takes all kinds, but definitely, in the end, it was probably a good decision to bring in Southeast because you brought in that organization from Alaska Native Brotherhood, Sisterhood, that was very entrenched. Like you mentioned earlier about the very differences in the way that meetings are run between the Arctic Slope and Southeast. And maybe people might have been a little bit intimidated by Southeast.
Oh, yes. I mean, Eben Hobson actually, you know, said that. I can't recall the details of it, but I know he did not support having Southeast in leadership pieces because can you imagine sitting across the table, you know, from John Borbridge, you know? Yeah, there was that recognition that Southeast did have command of organizations and how to run organizations. But we also had others like Willie Hensley. I mean, he played a pivotal role in ANCSA, in the leadership in that the task force, Governor Hickel.
Oh, yeah, Governor Hickel's task force that he put together because he knew he had to come to a compromise because he wasn't going to get his oil development unless he had that. Well, one of the things that is so fascinating about ANCSA, and I want to go back to the day that AFN gathered to vote on President Nixon's signing of ANCSA, was Emil Nadi's speech in which, and I'm going to play some of that. Let's stop here and play some of that speech.
And I can remember Alice Brown standing up and saying, here's $200. I remember Larry Skolkoff standing up and saying, here's $200 more. And we went around the room within a half hour. We raised, I think, $1,200 that sent Willie and I back to Washington, D.C. Those are the early sacrifices. How many board meetings did we hold in 67, 68, where people paid their own way into meetings, where they paid their own hotel rooms, where they took time away from their jobs? There have been many sacrifices and great expense to many people to bring this where we are today.
Emil Nadi in this speech talks about unity.
Yes.
And just how important that was. That was probably one of the best things that came out of ANGSA. In hindsight, when you hear that speech, Rosita, what do you think? You think he was right that the unity might have been the best thing that came out of ANGSA?
Well, I don't know if it might have been the best, but that unity was absolutely crucial to the success of moving that legislation through. And I think Emil was also wise enough to know that we were embarking on a journey that could prove divisive among the Native corporation. And we've seen it. You know, Section 7I, I mentioned Section 7I created a lot of division among the Native corporations, but yet it was that sense of unity that brought them together. Again, they threw out all of the lawyers and all of the accountants, and they said Native leadership are going to figure out how to make 7I work for all of us. And to their credit, they were able to do that. Section I is, you know, very complex piece of legislation. And when you get to the accounting of it, it's even more horrific. I think Emil Nadi knew that there were going to be these challenges that we as Native people were going to be facing. And of course, he was the great mediator, too, in bringing together the different regions, because we did have questions about land loss formulas. How are we going to allocate land, the 44 million acres among the different regions? And so I think he also has to be recognized for the role he played. And he was the right person to do it. His demeanor was right. He wasn't boisterous, and he was calming. And so I think it was just his way of being that he was able to establish and hold us together as a Native community. Bringing in Southeast, I think, was, well, of course, we owe him a tribute and acknowledge him for that.
So let's talk about the 7I profit sharing mechanism, which is part of ANGSA. To me, that seemed to be part of the genius of ANGSA, sort of the insurance policy for those corporations that didn't necessarily do very well in the beginning.
There was the recognition. I mean, we had Section 7I. So we knew that there were regions that had rich mineral resources. It also included timber development. And there were regions that did not have those kinds of resources. I made the mistake at one of my lectures when I was teaching at the university, calling those regions that there were the haves and the have-nots. And that's how that was characterized. And I remember a young lady, a young woman from one of those regions, and she was almost crying when she came up to me. And she said she really hated to be characterized as from the regions of the have-nots. And I hadn't even thought about it. And I apologized to her. I wasn't thinking about the people. I was thinking about the resources. We violated my own thinking about how we are one with the land and characterizing them as have-nots. At least I changed my rhetoric about Section 7I. And we've seen it and how it works to protect the region.
So can you explain for people who may not be familiar with how ANGSA works, how the profit-sharing mechanism was designed?
Well, the law says that regional corporations shall share 70% of their profits from mineral development or subsurface development and timber development. And then we go down into the villages. And so then they have to share 50% of that when it's distributed among all of the 12 regions. Then they have to share 50% of that income to village corporations. So on the face of it, it sounds simple. But when you start accounting for what constitutes a profit. These are in simple terms. What is a legitimate expense? And when do you value those resources? Do you value it at the beginning of the year, beginning of the fiscal year? Do you value it at the time of the selling? And so those things became really important. We actually had lawsuits between regions as to when was the valuation period, just when you booked the return, or was there another time? So we had to come to agreement to all of those finite decisions that had to be made. And of course, you know, you want to be able to maximize your revenues and keep as much as you want to within your region.
Oftentimes when I think of that 7i profit sharing mechanism, I'm reminded of the Monopoly board game that people play, and that it's a long game, right? You can lose everything, but when you pass go and collect $200 or you pick up a chance card, you wind up back in the game. And it seemed to me that the 7i profit sharing was in some ways like that. The corporations that were struggling is that they could always come back, pass go, collect some revenue that was through this profit sharing from those that were making money, and stay afloat. And it seemed to give some corporations time to get the knowledge that they needed to make profit.
Well, that's one way to look at it. But another way to look at it is look at our cultural values. Look at our cultural values of sharing. And I think actually it was Senator Stevens that acknowledged that our traditional cultures are based on sharing. And what does that sharing do? It creates bonds. It creates these relationships between those who are sharing and the recipient. And so you could look at as coming from our traditional practices of sharing as well. When I was doing my research in the Arctic, and there are different parts of, like, let's say the whale that goes to elders, you know, special parts for women. And I have to tell you that because I was whaling like a man and I was a woman, I got lots of whales one time. My stack of whale was really high because I got share as a hunter and I got share as a woman. But there was also shares for what they called the needy. And I was puzzled. I mean, were they thinking about welfare, poor people? And so I probed. I said, well, what do you mean? There's this share over here for the needy. And it was for households that don't have a hunter. Yeah. So it was women that didn't have a husband. Their husband had died, but there were special parts for elders. So they had these special categories for making sure that the society as a whole was taken care of. And then they expanded that into the modern period where they would share with elders who had gone into care facilities and even care facilities that were outside of their region. So the whole concept of sharing is very real to Native people. And that sharing really helps unite Native people. So even though, you know, we might call it in its modern day form, corporal socialism, it does have kind of a ring of traditional culture in the whole practice.
Well, it seems like turn taking is a part of this too, because if you look at Sea Alaska, for example, you brought up the fact that initially the bulk of AFN did not want to include Southeast Alaska, but wasn't it Sea Alaska's profits from timber that kept everybody going for a while? Weren't they the first profits to be shared?
Yes, it's true. So in the end, it does become an equalizer among all of the different regions. But there's also something else that I wanted to say about Section 7i, where the leadership recognized that education was so critical to our future that they all agreed that each region could keep out money for scholarships. So that's something a lot of people don't know, that there is Section 7i scholarships. And again, we have to recognize, you know, the forward thinking of our leaders who were recognizing that it was also going to be important for us to make sure that future generations were educated.
That is really fascinating, isn't it? Because that speaks to a priority.
Yes.
We've talked about how ANCSA has been a long game played out over the decades. And here we are at the 50-year milestone. And Native corporations have gone from struggling to having a huge impact on the Alaskan economy through their scholarships, their subsidiaries, which are all over the country. They bring expertise to the workforce that Alaska wouldn't otherwise have. So having said that, what do you see in the crystal ball for the next 10, 20 years for Native corporations?
Well, there is another dimension of Native corporations that I think is helping us build for our future. And I happen to have looked at all of the regional Native corporations, all of their mission statements. And I will say that almost 99% of them, there may be one corporation at that time when I was reviewing it, where in their mission statement, they talked about cultural values and they talked about education. It's in their mission statement along with the need to be profit-making. All of the Native corporations know that they need to be profit-making, but they've also added this cultural dimension and they have put their money, put their money where their mouth is, and they establish scholarship programs, and many of them have established cultural organizations like Sea Alaska Heritage Institute. And what are these cultural organizations doing? They are integrating language, culture, and arts into the schools. They are integrating it into institutions where our children are now learning not only our language, but they're learning about our culture. They are teaching teachers about our culture so that our teachers, many of whom are non-Native, can be teaching in the classroom. These Native organizations are supporting cultural organizations to develop curriculum material so that they have the teaching materials for teachers to be teaching about our culture. They are teaching teachers to have a better understanding and respect for our culture. So I see those youth, I see those students, not only with academic achievement improving, I am seeing that they have a grounding in our culture. And that's what I see. I used to tell my fellow board members at Sea Alaska, our kids know more about our culture than you do, because most of them were raised in the period where our society was repressing Native culture. But now our children are having the benefit of having a good academic instruction, learning, and plus integrating language and culture. And we know that this integration of language and culture into schools are helping to improve the academic standing of our children. We know that from all of the studies that we do evaluations of all of our programming. So I'm not saying that our children will be speaking Native languages like our ancestors did, but I will tell you that they are getting a better grounding in our culture. So I have to say, I have great hope for our future. And you know, I always tell people, we have survived, and we know scientifically that we have been here for more than 10,000 years. There's no question about it. So if you think about us as a people that have survived through climate change, through disruption of our society, to this really now revitalization of our culture, if you could think about how we survived those pandemics that wiped out whole villages, that wiped out 50% of our population, and we survived. So I think we have a strong culture, and now we're bringing it out into the opening, and we're bringing it into a whole flowering of a whole new society with this integration of Western culture and our traditional culture. I have great hope for the future.
thank Dr. Rosita Worrell for taking time out to help us understand why there is much more to the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act than meets the eye. When it was enacted 50 years ago, the Claims Act was the largest settlement of its kind in the history of the United States. It has been called a constitution for Alaska Natives because, like the U.S. Constitution, it's been amended many times to fix some of its problems. Before we go, we want to thank our partners in the project, the Alaska Native Media Group and the Alaska Moving Image Preservation Association, for their help. I'm Rhonda McBride. Thank you for joining us and hope we have given you an appreciation for how the Claims Act is really one of the great Alaskan stories that is still a work in progress.